Thank you, Mr. President. I am deeply honored to return to the Southern Seminary campus on this day. We are honored to join you and particularly to be asked to deliver the McCall Christian Leadership Lecture this year. To be with our good friends, President and Mrs. Moeller, is a genuine joy for Lanice and for me, and to see many friends on the Southern Seminary faculty and be able to visit with them today is a highlight indeed. So thank you for this honor to return to this gorgeous campus, which has never looked better, Mr. President, and it is a special thrill to be here with you today. I had the privilege of knowing Dr. Duke McCall, and to present lectures that have his name attached to them is a high honor indeed, and one that I do not take for granted in any way whatsoever. Today, I would like to talk to you about the times and seasons of leadership. And today is a talk or an address. It is not a sermon. It is in leadership theory, you approach leadership often from the standpoint of case studies. And so today we're going to do a case study of leadership from the inside of Southern Seminary and look at Southern Seminary as an example of a way to think about leadership during different times and different seasons and different transitions, different opportunities and challenges. Ecclesiastes chapter 3 talks about times and seasons. It teaches us that timing matters in life. Our time in this world is characterized by joy, harmony, conflict, life, and death. Each has its proper season. God has set a time and place for everything. The challenge for all of us is to determine the right time for the actions, words, and responses throughout our life, and particularly throughout our time of leadership opportunities. We must ever be mindful of the temporal framework that is built into the cycles of life. There are many things that come along to remind us of those things. But today, we think about some of those transitions and key moments and key times in the history of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. Job chapter 8, verses 8 through 10, reminds us to remember and to learn from the fathers, from those who have gone before us. And so today, we want to learn from those who have gone before us. Romans chapter 8 encourages us to lead purposefully, intentionally, diligently. And so putting these things together, I want this morning to listen and to learn from those who've gone before in order that we might learn to lead more wisely, more diligently. Doing so, as I said, from the inside of Southern Seminary's history as case studies for these times and seasons in which we now find ourselves. But we begin by thinking about some shared leadership principles in general. When we think about leadership, it is best understood within the twin pillars of stewardship and service. Or stated another way, stewardship of the reality of that leadership at its heart is service. Servant's heart, service to God, service to others, service that is marked by humility because of our dependence on God. Christian leaders are characterized as people who are above reproach, says Paul in 1 Timothy chapter 3. They are people who are hopeful and courageous, persevering. They exemplify trust in God. They are empowered by God's Spirit. They understand that leadership is done within community, and therefore we work together with one another in relationship with others, showing mutual respect for others. That sense, leadership is often characterized as a team, shepherding, guiding, working together, acknowledging our fallibility while recognizing the need to accommodate weaknesses in others as well. Leaders are accountable. They bear responsibility, and therefore they have the privilege among all the rest of God's people to influence others, whether it's a small group, a large group, whatever entity it might be, church, institution, organization, parachurch group, mission organization. There would be much for us to consider about each of those things this morning. But today I want to think about some of those qualities as they have worked themselves out, exemplified through some of the leaders that have shaped this place at Southern Seminary. So this morning we think about those times and those seasons, those times in which often a new president would come along. There have been 9 presidents in the history of Southern Seminary. And so this morning we're going to look at 9 case studies. It is not that you have to be the president or the primary leader of an entity in order to lead. I think what we're going to see this morning has application, or at least hopefully it does, for you wherever you are today, and not just for leadership in the future, and not just if you are the lead leader of an organization, but wherever God places you to serve, to exercise your gift. And so this morning, we begin appropriately with the founder of this place. With the founder of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, James Pettigrew Boyce. He was the chairman of the faculty and the first president. He was a graduate of Princeton Seminary and pastor of the First Baptist Church of Columbia, South Carolina, before becoming professor of theology at Furman in 1855. He dreamed of a Baptist seminary for people in the South. His vision for this school was revealed in 1856, which he brought an epoch-making historical address called Three Changes in Theological Education, or Three Changes in Theological Institutions. And his vision became a reality when the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary was birthed in Greenville, South Carolina in 1859. While certainly a capable theologian, an able administrator, a competent and even skilled financial manager, it was Boyce's vision that served as the most important aspect for giving energy and direction for the seminary from 1859 until his death in 1888. From President Boyce, we learn the necessity of visionary leadership. For the capacity for vision is a God-given potential or ability to present a preferred future for others within their current reality, which includes an understanding of the people within that community, of ourselves, our context, our times, and our seasons. President Boyce presented a vision that would make theological education more accessible for all. He also had a second idea that theological education in its specific form should be more academically rigorous, promoting serious scholarship. And then thirdly, it should be unapologetically confessional. And those three things, which many of you know so well, shaped the vision that transformed the life of theological education for Southern Baptists for the last 170 years. Vision transforms the life of the believing community and transforms the way things are done. It's more than an idea. Vision actually has the ability to see the end of a plan from the beginning, to inspire others to think about the current experience in ways that are different because they can see beyond where they actually are at this particular moment. And without such a coherent vision, churches, institutions, and organizations become confused. They become incompatible, often heading in the wrong direction. And the goal is not just for everyone to sit and admire the leader's vision, but for the vision to be embraced. There's to be adoption and buy-in so it becomes our vision for a particular community of faith. It was Dr. Boyce's vision that shaped the early decades of this seminary before he died in 1888, at which time there was a passing of the baton to the second president, John A. Broaddus. Many of you know John A. Broaddus. The baton was passed, not unlike Moses to Joshua. In many ways, the Boyce-Broaddus leadership was a duet, not a solo. They exemplified a shared team, and Dr. Broaddus participated in promoting team leadership during his days as leader on this campus. Quoting A.F. Fleet of Missouri, Greg Will says in his History of Southern Seminary, actually, there were two presidents. Broaddus' role was in some respects scarcely second to Boyce's, he said. Broaddus exercised leadership nearly equal to Boyce. They trusted each other, each other's judgment. They maintained remarkable accord and complemented one another. It was the complementary nature of their work and of their giftedness that made them such a powerful team. The team idea helped to promote the whole as greater than the sum of its parts. And that's what team leadership does. It calls for participation in a shared calling, in a shared mission, in a shared ideal. Team leadership then is built on the idea that everyone has something to contribute, something valuable for the context, and they will do so when the context allows those gifts to manifest themselves. The team then works together to embrace a shared vision, a shared mission, based around common gifts and calling. So while there was a shared leadership between Boyce and Broaddus, the two presidents, as Dr. Will said, actually had different gifts. And therefore, we, when we participate in leadership, we exercise our gifts and calling, as the Bible says, according to the grace given to us. Thus, leaders must use their gifts for good, for them to be effective within the life of the community. Sometimes mustering the courage to actually use one's spiritual gift of leadership is very difficult. Some look from the outside and think that it's easy work, but it's actually a great challenge. Sometimes our perceived understanding of our gift collides with the situation, the time, or the season in which we are involved. I often tell people that leadership is not a non-contact sport. I tell them that leaders need the head of a scholar, the heart of a child, and the hide of a rhinoceros. And sometimes it seems that God makes the gift known only in the midst in which that gift is needed. Ultimately, James Boyce and John Broaddus saw that together they could work toward accomplishing what God wanted to see done, but their ultimate calling was not to success, it was to faithfulness. The importance of faithfulness must drive the motivation of a leader. For you see, it is neither the one who plants nor the one who waters is anything, for it is God who causes the growth. It is God who gives the increase. That was the desire of the Apostle Paul. That has been the desire of all faithful leaders since that time, including John A. Broaddus. From 1889 to 1895, Broaddus officially served as the second president. He faithfully exercised his leadership gifts for the good of others and for the good of the seminary. Though I must say, he probably did so reluctantly, because he would have preferred to exercise his gifts of scholar, teacher, and preacher. And while it may be obvious to all that John Broaddus should be named the president following the death of Dr. Boyce, the same could not be said the person who was to be president following John Broaddus when he passed away in 1895. We remember John Broaddus not only as brilliant scholar and masterful preacher, but as faithful team leader. When he passed away, a popular faculty member and insightful historian, William Whitsitt, became the seminary's third president in 1895. Whitsitt had challenged the landmarkist understanding of Baptist history, the unbroken succession of immersion baptism since the time of the apostles. The challenge escalated into a major public dispute which threatened to divide the Southern Baptist Convention and bring great harm to the seminary. The challenge became a public risk for Whitsitt's presidency. So when we think about President Whitsitt, we want to think about it in terms of a leadership lesson regarding risk-taking. While most Baptist historians now view Baptist history within the framework similar to that proposed by Whitsitt, for our purposes today, we need to explore the implications of his public risk in exposing this idea for his leadership at the seminary. Again, Greg Will says that Dr. Whitsitt understood history well, but he failed to understand his own context. Certainly, risk-taking is an essential aspect of leadership. One cannot lead without taking certain informed risks, moving forward in unswerving faith, but you must understand the context, the timing. That must be key in order to move forward at such a time. Leaders must be tireless, observant, hopeful, willing to take risks at the right time and the right place. but it seems to me that the right thing done at the wrong time, or the right thing done for the wrong reason, is really the wrong decision or the wrong thing. And it's often difficult to recover in a context when that happens. President Whitsitt misunderstood his context, which was the case that led to his failure as a president at Southern Seminary. As leaders, what do you do when you misunderstand a context, when you misunderstand the timing? Well, certainly the first thing you want to do is offer an apology. You learn from your mistakes. You trust God for another opportunity. You hope for a new start. But sometimes all you can do is move on, which was the case with President Whitsitt when he resigned in 1899. Risk-taking is good at the right time and the right place. And godly leaders must be willing to do so. It can be quite problematic when we misread the times and the seasons and the context in which we are trying to make important decisions for the life of a church, an organization, or an institution. When President Whitsitt resigned, it opened the door for a new leader. New leader who came from a pastorate in Massachusetts. This leader was the fourth president of the seminary, E.Y. Mullins. Born in 1860 in Mississippi, E.Y. Mullins graduated from Texas A&M before coming to study at Southern Seminary in 1881. He had hoped to serve overseas as a missionary before following God's direction to pastoral ministry in Maryland and Massachusetts. And as I mentioned, it was from that pastorate in Massachusetts that he was called to serve as the fourth president here in 1899. Recognizing that the seminary needed to understand that it faced a new moment, a different moment, because of the resignation of President Whitsitt, Mullins was both change agent and influencer. He was one who could see the moment, to recognize what was needed, to adapt to the times. Change agents are active and persuasive in that way, and E.Y. Mullins was a masterful change agent. Became instruments to tackle the challenges of the season of leadership, recognizing the need for bold and decisive direction. He recognized there was confusion in the midst, and Mullins brought to the seminary bold leadership associated with those who are change agents in an organization. As change agent, he brought the campus here and relocated to this place where we now carry out the work of the seminary. He built Norton Hall and what is now known as Mullins Hall, as well as Rice and Judson Hall, which we now call the Legacy Center. This bold leadership influenced the entire Southern Baptist Convention while redeveloping the campus at this current location. Not only did he influence the campus, I can't get this to move forward. There we go. Not only did he influence the campus and the denomination, but he influenced far beyond Baptist life through his statesmanlike leadership, teaching, preaching, his writing, his works on publications like Christian Religion and Its Doctrinal Expression, The Axioms of Religion, Baptist Belief, Why is Christianity True, Christianity at the Crossroads. He demonstrated the power of persuasion. For almost 30 years, E.Y. Mullins' giant-sized abilities touched Baptists everywhere and pointed the seminary forward for the changing world of the 20th century. He died in 1928 following a massive stroke. E.Y. Mullins was truly a model of dynamic change. He recognized the distinctiveness of the moment. But following his death, an Alabamian, an Old Testament scholar, assumed the presidency. John R. Sampey, along with his colleague James Dobbins, guided the seminary through some of the most difficult days in the seminary's history. From 1929 to 1942, the years characterized by national depression and world wars, called for a different kind of leadership. It called for a leadership of encouragement. John R. Sampey was a great teacher and preacher with the heart of an evangelist. And President Sampey shouldered the challenges of the time by encouraging others to join with him in sacrificing for the good of the seminary. As an encouraging leader, President Sampey was able to face challenging days with courage and with a strong will. He communicated his trust in others to build them up so that they would be willing to follow and they could work together, recognizing the sovereignty and providence of God even in the midst of those times. He encouraged others to follow God's providential guidance, recognizing that without faith in God's faithfulness, they could never make it through. A leader needs to be trustworthy in order to joyfully attempt to help others. Doing difficult things in difficult times requires the courage to be an encourager. And encouragers like John R. Sampi empowered others by example, personal sacrifice, and encouragement. He was a model of encouragement in difficult days. He stepped aside from the presidency in 1942 prior to his death, which came about in 1946. All leaders must learn to provide encouragement for others in good times and bad, but especially during those difficult and often unexpected moments, which will come for all of us at some point during our time of leadership. So, through these first five case studies, what have we learned? To summarize, we can say that it took vision to launch the beginning of this seminary, a vision that would sustain the work of this place. But when Dr. Broaddus came along, he did not need to re-envision the work of the seminary. He needed to gather a team together that would provide continuity to carry the vision forward. Following Whitsitt's failed presidency, doing the right thing at the wrong time, E.Y. Mullins boldly stepped onto the field, recognizing the moment, bringing change and new direction for the seminary. Yet in a more difficult time, when John R. Sampi was called to be the president, the external circumstances were such that there was not a need for a new vision nor for a change agent, but the need for an encourager. Someone who would walk beside the others to carry the load, calling all to sacrifice for the good of the whole. But moving out of the war years, the seminary needed more than a source of encouragement. As vital as that was to the seminary's survival in the 1930s, the trustees turned to Ellis Fuller. They turned to a pastor from Atlanta, Georgia. Fuller was originally from South Carolina. He had attended the seminary just like Whitsitt, just like Mullins, just like Sampi, but his calling was primarily that of a pastor rather than a scholar. And when he was invited to become the seminary's sixth president in 1942, Fuller was serving as pastor of the Tall Steeple Church, the First Baptist Church of Atlanta. He had gathered a reputation there as an astute business mind, a person with keen managerial skills, and he brought those qualities to the presidency of the seminary as well, distinguishing himself as a careful planner, as an organizational overseer, as a capable manager. Using these gifts, he turned the seminary presidency away from being the chairman of the faculty into the direction of chief administrator, a significant and historic change in the life of this place. Managers like Ellis Fuller make wise and prayerful observations. They watch and listen to make wise choices. They know when and how to ask for help. They respond carefully to strife and external opposition, taking thoughtful steps along the way. Ellis Fuller then was a wise manager who recognized timing as the key for implementation of plans. Often tell new leaders not to overestimate what can be done in 1 year and never underestimate what can be done in five, because planning is the key to carrying forward a vision, an idea, the work together. Fuller accomplished much during the shaping of this campus, building this chapel in which we are gathered here today, for he died from an unexpected heart attack, October 28, 1950. The lecture that I am privileged to give today is named in honor of Duke K. McCall, the longest-serving president in Southern Seminary's magnificent history. The son of a judge, Dr. McCall seemed destined for exceptional leadership. As Dr. Moeller has said, before coming to be the president at Southern Seminary, he had already been the pastor at the Broadway Baptist Church, the president of New Orleans Seminary, and the leader of the executive committee, and he came here to be president at the age of 37. And if all those things were not enough, McCall was named president of the Baptist World Alliance following his three decades of service here at the seminary. Strategic, thoughtful, effective, President McCall remarkably placed his stamp on the campus of Southern Seminary and the Southern Baptist Convention like few others in Southern Baptist history. His strategic, thoughtful leadership reached far beyond this campus, and his fingerprints rested almost everywhere in SBC life. He brought to the work of the presidency of Southern Seminary a multifaceted strategy on how to connect campus and convention, how to increase enrollment at the seminary, how to grow the endowment, how to develop the campus so that the James Boyce Centennial Library could be built and Cook Hall behind us in 1970. New marks of academic excellence came during Dr. McCall's leadership, even following the squabbles with the faculty in the late 1950s. And he had the courage to address key civil rights issues like few other Southern Baptists of his time. Few people in Southern Baptist history have had the abilities of the multi-talented Duke McCall. But we can learn from him even if we don't have those abilities. Learning to think strategically in multifaceted ways, whatever our leadership role is, recognizing that without some piece of strategy and planning, we will not be able to move forward. Dr. McCall was a masterful statesman and strategist for his time. Often when there is a long tenure in leadership, one looks at the void that might be left because of one's lengthy leadership, and those who are responsible for bringing along the next leader sometimes try to correct that with a pendulum swing. Such was the case with the election of the 8th president at Southern Seminary. Born in Grenada, Mississippi, Roy L. Honeycutt became president here in 1982 following the retirement of Dr. Duke McCall. A Southern Seminary graduate, a recognized Hebrew scholar, Dr. Honeycutt had served as professor and dean at Midwestern Seminary prior to becoming dean and provost at Southern Seminary in the 1970s. What Dr. Honeycutt brought to the presidency was a gift for friendship and relationship. He was a relational leader who was appreciated and liked by his colleagues who called themselves friends of Roy. People on this campus actually had maroon baseball caps with gold letters on the front that said, Friends of Roy. He was a person who brought this relational gift to tough, conflicting times in the life of the seminary and in the life of the denomination. He tried to work through those times, bringing his relational skills to bear on building consensus with his famous covenant statement. He tried to lead and to navigate through these choppy waters in a relational way. And relationships are huge, a high priority for any leader, anytime, anywhere. But what happens when those relationships become dysfunctional? Relationships often become challenging in such an unstable context. Relationships are not effective in that kind of difficult situation. Whether in a church, an organization, an institution, when it's more characterized by conflict than consensus. And such was certainly the case at Southern Seminary in the late 1980s and the early 1990s. Trying to create and develop community on the campus in the midst of external conflict resulted in internal strife that was almost overwhelming, even someone of Dr. Honeycutt's giftedness. Consensus building is a high priority for a relational leader, but consensus needs shared commitments and convictions, especially regarding the mission, purpose, and identity of an organization. When Dr. Honeycutt announced his retirement in 1992 here in this chapel, I was speaking on that day. I remember it well. Seminary trustees then set out to find someone who could bring those shared commitments, those needed convictions, to this place, and they found their answer in a 33-year-old man with an amazing theological ability, with a working knowledge of the history of this seminary like few others. A native of Florida, a graduate of Samford University, Albert Moeller had gained the attention as a brilliant student by the Southern Seminary faculty. He had garnered the confidence of the denominational leadership through his masterful editorial work at the Georgia State paper, The Christian Index. It was from that role that this convictional leader became the seminary's youngest president in 1993. Now, for most of you who are here, you cannot imagine another seminary than the one that you now experience, one shaped by solid theological conviction. You can hardly imagine Southern Seminary any other way. But you need to know, however, that President Moeller has brought about a remarkable transformation by convictional leadership, which is both theologically informed and theologically shaped. Your president recognized how crucial, how important it was and is for theology to form the foundation of Christian leadership. Grounded in an understanding of the sovereignty and the providence of God, Dr. Moeller has used his calling and giftedness to shape the mission, the identity, the purpose of this place for this time and this season. With wisdom and conviction, he understood and articulated and presented these priorities in a theologically shaped manner, grounded in God, revelation, and authority. In doing so, President Moeller has reclaimed the vision of James P. Boyce and the tradition that provided the framework for the early decades of this seminary. He has brought to the forefront a renewed commitment to classical, Baptist, Orthodox, and evangelical scholarship, which he himself embodies, which has influenced his activities and decision-making in this place for more than two decades. So today we all salute President Moeller. We thank him for his convictional leadership in this anniversary year of his presidency. And as my time this morning comes to an end, we must ask what leadership lessons there are for us to learn from all of these leaders. We have seen that vision is necessary, essential to launch and sometimes to relaunch and guide an organization. For without vision, there is no coherent direction. Secondly, we have seen that teamwork that is complementary in nature and giftedness is valuable. It leads to shared consensus, working together, and creates continuity in the life of an institution. Number three, we've seen that risk-taking is good and commendable when done at the right time for the right reasons. Number four, we've seen that bold change agents can make a huge difference in the right context when they recognize the distinctiveness of the moment. Number five, we have seen that caretaking and encouragement are important in the life of a church, an organization, or an institution, particularly is that the case during difficult days. Number six, we have seen that managers, strategists, and relational community builders are vital, especially when trying to move an organization to maturity, to expand its reach and influence. Such was certainly the case at Southern Seminary in the middle of the 20th century, as it was such a key part of a denomination coming of age. But number seven, we have seen that all of these things need convictional grounding and theological direction. For without such commitments, these efforts lose shape and become disconnected from their Christ-centered mission, their God-directed purpose. Lastly, we can say that effectiveness and efficiency are important aspects and priorities of leadership, but never apart from theological grounding. When effectiveness and efficiency become the primary focus in the organization of an institution, its identity becomes amorphous. It then is vital to have the courage to call an organization or an institution back to its vision, to its purpose. For you see, management strategy alone can only take you so far. And at times when you get off track, it is necessary for leaders to say, we need to get back on track or cease to exist. For you see, at times it is better to cease to exist than to cease to matter. Such probably has been the case, or should have been the case, with hundreds of colleges and universities, organizations and seminaries across the country that have lost their theological compass since the founding of Harvard University in 1636. But all of these traits and qualities that we have observed today are needed to have a full-orbed, healthy organization. But at times, as we have seen, different times and seasons along the way with an entity or in the times and seasons of a leader himself, what we need is to recognize that one perhaps needs to be prominent at the moment, taking priority and precedent over the others in order for the health of an organization to survive. But when we misread those times and seasons, the results can be most problematic, as was the case during the Whitsitt era. As those of you who are here today as students move into new leadership opportunities that will develop for you when you leave this campus, you need to ask God to give you keen sensitivity to help you match your calling, your giftedness, with the context, the times, the seasons to which you will be called. This morning I've tried to stay away from talking about leadership only in terms of methods and how-to practices. There certainly is a place for that, but today's reflections are grounded in the reality that primarily a Christian leader is called to be an instrument of grace, calling people to eternal life, to restore that which only the life-giving Spirit of God can accomplish, and to multiply these efforts by sending other leaders to new contexts. For you see, not only did James Boyce prepare John Broadus for leadership here, but he prepared Basil Manley Jr. and F.H. Kerfoot for leadership beyond Southern Seminary, as President Moeller has done time and time again. For a leader's life is not primarily about an organization, and it's not primarily about success. A leader's life is primarily about being characterized by the worship of God, by authentic discipleship, by spiritual and ministry formation, a life that God uses for His purposes in a church, in an organization, an institution, or another community of faith. It is my prayer that God will somehow use this time together this morning, this McCall Lectureship in 2013, for good in your life and for your thinking in leadership formation, to help you in your stewardship and service, the twin pillars of leadership, as you influence others, the primary responsibility of leadership, grounded in biblical and theological conviction, with great wisdom that only God can give, with a kingdom focus and orientation. When that is done and carried out for the glory of God, I pray that you will see God's favor rest upon your leadership in whatever place you are called to serve. My prayer this day is that God's blessings will continue to rest upon this great place, the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. And I pray that His blessings will be yours in the days to come. Thank you very much.